Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the ID the Future podcast. This is Casey Luskin broadcasting from the Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. And again today we have on our show a very special guest, Dr. Lyle Jensen, who is Professor Emeritus at the University of Washington and a Fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. This is actually a six-part series where we will actually get into some of Dr. Jensen's views on evolution in the final two podcasts. Dr. Jensen has already been on three podcasts on the show discussing his personal history, talking about how he became interested in science. Then he talked about his career as a graduate student. And then in the most recent podcast, he talked about working on the Manhattan Project. And we're fortunate to have Dr. Jensen again with us today to talk about his career as a scientist. Now, you were an X-ray crystallographer, and I think that our listeners have probably heard of X-ray crystallography before.
Yes.
So let me just try to summarize. You take a chemical compound, You crystallize it, You shoot it with a beam of X-rays. The X-rays then deflect off of that compound based upon the crystallized structure of that compound. Yeah. They bounce back and they hit a film where you then measure the angles where they hit the film. Is that...
Well, I wouldn't say bounce back. I would call it reflect.
They reflect. Okay. Yeah. But by measuring the angles where the beams are being reflected or refracted, you're able to calculate the types of bonds, the angles of the bonds, and learn about what are the...
Whole geometry.
There's one catch here, which I think maybe would be interesting for our listeners to know about, and that's that when you first started in your career, the field of X-ray crystallography didn't even really hardly exist. Is that correct?
Well, it existed, but when I got into the field, this was early in the 1950s, fast computers were just starting to come. We were using just desk calculators.
Bill Gates was still in diapers then, probably. So
just about. But what it amounted to is you must take these diffraction effects and then you must compute where the atoms are, what kind of a diffraction pattern they would develop. Mm. We used to feel that we were spending 80% of our time doing computing. And then computers were starting to come. Mm. In about, I think it was 1953, there was a committee, a number of us on the campus. In 2 to 3 years, we had gained in speed 1,000 times faster than by hand. And so immediately, we started working on larger and larger structures.
So maybe what I'm understanding from you is that a lot of the theoretical basis for X-ray crystallography was developed before you were actually able to put it into practice through computing. Is that correct?
That's right. The Boortzenkrieg model, that was published in 1953. Mm-hmm. By 1955, the 604 coming, we could work on, in fact, I worked on two of the four of the building blocks of DNA.
Really? Of the nucleotides?
Get a more accurate theoretical side to things. But then from then on, with the 650, then it was just we moved to larger and larger and larger structures. And by 1960, I was interested in protein structure. I knew that at Cambridge, England, that we're working on solving proteins. Mm-hmm. And so I decided that I wanted to spend a year sabbatical there. Watson was an American, but Crick was still there. And I shared an office with one of the English scientists, and it was right near their coffee hour where they assembled for a morning coffee, and Crick would entertain them with jokes. But it turned out by that time I had refined some pretty large structures, not proteins yet, but proteins was going to be my goal, because that's the ultimate as far as crystallography is concerned, because if you can get the structure of the proteins, then as you get where all the atoms are, and the pharmaceutical companies, when they're developing drugs in this, they need the structure of various proteins. Then there was an American from UCLA, and he was doing a postdoctoral, and Kendrew assigned him to start the refinement. And you see, when we get an approximate structure, we have to refine that structure to get really good distances. Mm. And what the refinement means is we start with an approximate structure because I was interested in highly accurate positions, and that's what you get when you refine. And yet, John Kendra, I think himself, gave one of the papers, but the R value was still up around 40%. It hadn't refined. Mm. John Kendra and Max Perutz, they shared the Nobel Prize as well as Watson and Crick. Mm. And so if a world-famous laboratory with Nobel Prize winners, then if they can't do it, it can't be done. And the idea grew up in the field that proteins can't be refined. Mm. And I said to myself that I want to be able to do these larger structures. And so then when I came back, I ordered some better equipment for doing the larger structures.
So you came back from Cambridge, where a Nobel Prize winning lab said that solving protein structure couldn't be done using X-ray crystallography. So when did you start trying to resolve protein structure?
1964 was the beginning of our going on to proteins. The first thing I wanted to do was start with a smaller protein and show that refinement could be done with proteins, just exactly like what the small structures can do.
Mm-hmm. So you wanted to try to meet the challenge of no one was able to resolve the structures, and you were trying to find a way to do this.
Refine them. I wanted to get accurate structures so it would be useful to pharmaceutical companies and medical people as far as medical science was concerned. And what turned out was that the first protein we started was called ferredoxin, and it was about 6,000 molecular weight, and there were a number of iron and sulfur atoms in it. We could immediately show that what had been proposed for the structure by the chemist, that it was not that structure, but then in 1967, I was invited to talk about this ferredoxin, and a scientist from the National Institutes of Health by the name of Walter Loewenberg, he showed some beautiful red crystals, a protein that he named rubidoxin, red for the red color, and he showed it, and it was a very stable protein, again about 6,000, about the same size as ferredoxin. And when I looked at it, I thought, my, that is really something. That would be really the one that would be preferable to work on, because it was so stable compared to the ferredoxin. And at that point, he leaned over and said, how would you like some crystals of this rubidoxin? And I don't recall exactly what I said, but it was something like, any time you offer crystals to a crystallographer, he's got his apron out to accept whatever you have. He said that he was on a charter flight to Japan later that month. The flight that he was on was setting down for refueling at Seattle for the flight across the Pacific. And he said, if I haven't sent you a sample of these crystals by that time, if you'll meet me at the airport where the plane lands for refueling, I'll bring the crystals along and give them to you. And so I said, well, that will be great. And so it turned out that at 9 o'clock on the morning of the flight, we went to the South Terminal when they opened the doors, and here was Walter Loewenberg, and he saw us right away. And as he got down to the main floor, he took out a test tube that he had these crystals in. And here were some beautiful red crystals in solution.
And this was obviously before the modern era where you can't go near passengers who have just come off a plane. You have to, you know, with the security measures now, this could never have happened.
No, this couldn't. Anyway, when we got back to the lab, the goal was to show that proteins could be refined, and because the idea had gone, you couldn't refine protein. Yep. The net of it was 1 year almost exactly, within just a couple of days, the program had all been written as we were ready to start the refinement. The structure was solved, and the first maps were calculated. The first structure was plotted out on sheets, and when I just lifted it up a little bit, here I could see the contours, and here was density showing where the atoms were, and the structure was solved then. Now it was, could it be refined? The R value started out just a little below 38 or 39%, and the first cycle of refinement, the R value went down to, I think it was something like 36%. The next cycle, it went down to something like 32%. Four cycles of refinement, the R value went from about 40% down to 22 or 23%. In each one of these, I did the interpretation myself because I wanted to see, was it all making sense, and were the atomic positions reasonable? And it turned out that it was just a larger structure, but it behaved just like a smaller one. And I think it was something like three or four more cycles, and the R value was down to 12 to 14%.
Wow.
And R values will go below that for smaller structures where you get very precise positions. Now I could really show that proteins could be refined.
Mm. Were you one of the first then to refine a larger structure through X-ray crystallography?
That showed that proteins could be refined. But okay. See, the people who knew me, if I said a thing, that he could believe it, because you can get too optimistic, you know, and even in science believe what's wrong. But the important thing was that now we could really do the protein structures and get good protein structures. And now the computers are so fast, instead of a year or two or three, the synchrotron sources, they can collect data and do structures now in a matter of days.
Mm.
And it's just amazing as what's happened in the field.
Let's switch gears a little bit, because I know that aside from being one of the first to successfully elucidate the structure of a large compound, you then went on and wrote a textbook that was groundbreaking in your field. So tell us just a little bit about this textbook and some of the interesting stories that go along with that.
Well, we decided to call it X-ray Structure Determination, A Practical Guide. The first edition then was published in 1967 or 68 or thereabouts.
And did this become a very widely used textbook for
it
teaching?
Turned out over about a 20-year period. It sold roughly 10,000 volumes. Mm. It was about the number of crystallographers in the world.
I think I want to close this out just asking you very briefly about a couple of the awards and acclaim that you received for your accomplishments in advancing the field of X-ray crystallography. In the 1980s, you received an award from the American Crystallographic Association. Is that right?
Well,
I think it was 83.
I received what was called the Van Kuken Award.
Okay, and what was that for?
That was for when we were working with these smaller structures, we were actually locating hydrogen atoms.
Mm-hmm.
And in our book, we have a picture of in that first edition of hydrogen atoms.
Okay.
You see, by that time, for small structures, X-ray crystallography had gotten sufficiently detailed. See, a hydrogen has only one electron.
Yeah.
And we could actually locate where the hydrogens were.
Wow. So that was your Van Kuken Award.
The Van Kuken Award was for accurate structures.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2000, I was awarded the Berger Award, and that was essentially for larger structures.
In addition to this, I know you're a very humble man, but you're also elected fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science.
Yeah, and that was a complete surprise to me.
Oh, really?
To be elected, because I wasn't paying any attention to things. I was enjoying getting good structures.
That's the way it should be.
Yeah, but also I'm a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences.
When you retired, it was a big deal. They had a 3-day symposium with scientists from around the world that came and presented papers in your honor. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
I guess my final question is, how do you remember all of this? Because I don't even remember what I had for breakfast 3 days ago. You remember all these amazing details of your career. I'm always just amazed and just in awe of ability to retell these stories, and they come alive today. So thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to do interviews with you. This is Casey Luskin with the ID the Future podcast. Signing off. Thanks for listening.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Bennett. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.